looking at the cause and effect. And they also didn't focus on the days that preceded what they call the riot, where people were actually in the streets peacefully protesting. So of course they're gonna spin it.
On May 21st, a grand jury indicted several of the officers involved with Gray's arrest. But in December 2015, a Baltimore judge declared a mistrial in the trial of one officer after the jury was unable to reach a verdict. The images of police wearing helmets and masks, toting assault rifles, and riding in mind-resistant armored vehicles in Baltimore and Ferguson has also raised widespread criticism of what has been dubbed the militarization of local police forces.
Difference, I think, in the last 5 or 10 years, you've got the intense militarization of police departments. So the police department still engaged in arbitrary policing when I was growing up, but they didn't have the military equipment that they have now. And the very fact that what the last 10 years or so, every 28 hours, there's a black or brown person who's killed by a police or security guard.
I think that military-grade equipment should be allocated to police department, but never ever used against civilians. Military-grade equipment should be used in active shooter situation, terrorist attack, but never against a civilian unrest. And I, in my mind, it was a horrible error of judgment.
We need action. By action, I mean transformation of institutions. By action, I mean redistribution of the wealth downward. By action, I mean high-quality jobs, high-quality education. By action, I mean high-quality communities where people can live with dignity. By action, I mean police who are accountable, who are punished by law if they murder other folk or arbitrarily treat other folk in ways in which they ought not. So we're talking about just radical democracy. We need people's power. We need the sharing of power.
Unfortunately, I think that what we've seen with the killings of the officers in New York in 2014 and what we've seen in Dallas recently, unfortunately, I think that this is not the end of retaliation against law enforcement officers by certain individuals who feel that police profession and officers, no matter what department they come from, represent this oppressive and brutal treatment of minorities. After all, if somebody thinks about democracy and democratic principle and wanting to live in a democratic country, they have to realize that policing is a pillar of democracy. And if there are issues of concern, these issues of concern have to be discussed and have to be brought to the attention of the local politicians, but never, ever they should be translated into any violent behavior, especially towards the ones who overall are charged with the protection of all of us.
One major goal that we have is to tie federal funding of local police forces to a prerequisite that they provide data regarding their shootings, especially in the cases of when they're shooting unarmed civilians, and then also to tie that to the mandatory use of body cameras. So that's a huge goal because I think transparency is necessary. I don't think there's enough data out there, and so that's another reason why people are able to dismiss this issue. Another goal is to have an independent prosecutor to prosecute police in cases of police violence, especially against unarmed people, because I think it will restore faith for those of us who have lost it in our criminal justice system. People believe that the grand jury system is antiquated and leaves police to kill with impunity, and so I think that this would be one way to help resolve that issue.
You know, a lot of people ask me, like, why do I protest? And because it's an ongoing problem, and I can pretend that it's not going on. I can pretend that it's not happening, but there will be a new hashtag to learn. There'll be a new face the next day. And so we continue to march and move forward and get more organized and get serious, because I don't want my children to still be marching. My grandparents marched. My mother was involved in activism work. And so I don't want to pass this along. I want to be able to tell them the story of how we overcame, how we were able to come together and fight this greater evil. And just, I don't want my children to experience it. You know, I don't want them to grow up being afraid, or teaching them to be afraid of police.
You don't know when the catalyst will be in place. Why did Rosa Parks become the catalyst as opposed to the earlier black woman who sat down on the bus just a few months earlier? It's hard to say when the spark in place takes off, the fire begins to expand, intensifies, and the next thing you know, you got a whole host of people on fire for justice. And lo and behold, people take off and it becomes contagious. You don't know when it's going to become contagious. It is contagious now. We are still living in the moment of Ferguson, Baltimore, and things will continue and I hope intensify.
I was told that I'm an activist from the way that I've been doing. I never thought I would be doing this type of work. I've never been the talkative type of person, this outspoken, but this made me who I am. And you know, this is my life mission right now, like, to become an activist, become a civil rights lawyer, you know, to bring justice some way, somehow to America. This helps me. This helps me a lot. Speaking to people and being out here is more of a support than, you know, shutting down or just crying all the time. I believe that the reforms is going to happen, but I believe that it's going to take a long time. It's going to take a lot of powerful people to be on the same page. What do I fear the most? That when my daughter get older, this will still be going on with no change.
Black Lives Matter is a multiracial movement. Because if Black Lives Matter, given the depth of white supremacy in America, then all lives will matter. Because usually it's the black lives that are the last ones that have value. But the indigenous lives will matter, the Asian lives, the white lives, the brown lives, if black lives matter. And that's what makes that movement so crucial. And I'm just so very proud and blessed to be an old school brother who's a small part of that movement led by young folks.
The Black Lives Matter movement, sparked by incidents of police violence, is an ideological and political movement fighting for black empowerment and equality. The movement has grown from the hashtag Black Lives Matter to include protests and demonstrations in every major city in America.
Well, for now, it seems that police brutality and racial injustice is not going to stop in the U.S. in the near future. And statistics show that many black Americans are skeptical that their country will ever make the changes necessary for racial equality. Perhaps only time will tell if America will ever be the land of the free. And that's a wrap for this week. Hope you will join us next week for another program. Goodbye for now.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5 and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/EN. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
The Limelight.
The Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation, IHME, at the University of Washington in Seattle predicts that between now and December 1st, the United States will see over 107,000 additional deaths from COVID-19. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Chris Walker, journalist. This article is published under the heading 107,000 New U.S. COVID Deaths Predicted by December, Health Model Says. Stay tuned, please, for the details of this article. A widely respected health model has some grim predictions for the next few months' trajectory of U.S. coronavirus deaths, but also offers some hope for how the country can save tens of thousands of lives simply by wearing masks again. The Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation, IHME, at the University of Washington in Seattle predicts that between now and December 1st, the United States will see over 107,000 additional deaths from COVID-19. But if everyone in the country agreed to wear masks, In public spaces, that projection would be cut in half. Researchers involved in the project said, "We can save 50,000 lives simply by wearing masks. That's how important behaviors are," said Ali Mokhtad, a professor of health metrics at the University of Washington, who is part of the IHME project. Lauren Ansel Mayers, director of University of Texas COVID-19 Modeling Consortium, agreed, telling the Associated Press that behavior is really going to determine if, when, and how sustainably the current wave subsides. Mayers added that other mitigation efforts, including limiting social interactions and getting more people vaccinated, are ways Americans can control how many get sick in the coming weeks and months. Taking action recently could help prevent many of the predicted deaths, the HME model suggests. Daily fatality numbers are expected to increase to nearly 1,400 deaths per day by mid-December. Then slowly, that number is expected to lessen over the next few months. While getting Americans to mask up, particularly in indoor public spaces where many localities are now requiring them, has been a significant challenge since the start of the pandemic. Polling suggests that most Americans are already wearing their masks again when they leave their homes and are supportive of local mandates, especially for school children who are not yet eligible for the COVID-19 vaccines. An Axios Ipsos poll from earlier this month found that 69% of Americans support masking requirements in schools, while only 30% said they opposed such rules. A recent USA Today Ipsos poll also found that 72% of Americans viewed local mask mandates as a matter of health and safety, rejecting the idea that they are an infringement on personal liberty. When asked to describe their current masking habits, an economist YouGov poll from past week showed that 55% of Americans were already wearing masks always or most of the time when they left their homes. However, a sizable proportion of respondents, that is about 45%, said they only wore masks some of the time or never. A number of state governors, too, stand in the way of local governments being able to make their own rules on masking. Governors Greg Abbott and Ron DeSantis, for example, have both issued rules against school districts in their respective states, from being able to require students and staff from having to wear masks to prevent the spread of the virus. Several districts in both states have said they will not adhere to their governor's orders, however, and have issued rules on masking anyway.
Bring us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
And welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. U.S. President Joe Biden and Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett met the White House on Friday, reiterating Washington's unshakable support for the Israeli regime, a rogue regime with at least 100 nuclear warheads. Tel Aviv wants the U.S. to pressure Iran to allegedly prevent it from obtaining nuclear weapons. Biden, like his predecessors, will not say no to the Zionist regime. Biden said he will try diplomacy with Tehran, but doesn't rule out other options. And just what are those other options? Well, we're going to look at all of this on the Spotlight. I'd like to welcome my guests to the program out of Tehran, political analyst Mostafa Khoshchesh. And out of Iowa, political commentator and peace activist Brian Terrell.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Thank you both for being with us here on The Spotlight. Well, let me start it off with Mostafa. Mostafa, I mean, it's interesting. They talk about diplomacy, but when they sit together, it's like these two rogue regimes and talking about possible terrorist acts. Your analysis of what was said by Biden in that meeting with Bennett.
Hello, Marzia, and thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming.
Definitely, the Israelis have been trying to intimidate Iran, to push Tehran to the talks. And, you know, this has been the case for the past 2 decades. But it's not just intimidation. It's an instrument which plays within a plan which is of strategic importance. There are two strategic incentives for the Israelis to do that. Well, first, ever since 2002, the Israelis have been trying to raise threats against Iran. At times, they have released reports saying that they were preparing for likely attacks, and then they said, they claimed that the attack was impending or even in the offing. Until 2007, around that time, Iran staged its first missile drills. And then the Israelis changed the field. They were, you know, held back. And then they changed plan, went for sabotage, terrorist operations, assassinating Iranian nuclear scientists, and Stuxnet playing, you know, they were partner in the Stuxnet cyber attack on Iranian nuclear facility. And they left the military threats to the U.S. And that was the case within the United States containment strategy, which is the only formula has been on the way. They've been, you know, working on that under Obama until the JCPOA was struck in 2015. This containment strategy depends very much on military threat as well as sanctions. And of course, there are other leverages that have been taken, you know, into use by Obama and the United States against Iran in all soft, semi-hard, and hard areas like foreign currency meddling, media warfare, psychological operation, and so on and so forth. But sanctions and threats, military threats, have been the main two options. But ever since, 2018, when Donald Trump exited the deal and raised excessive demands for more JCPOAs over regional issues and missile issues, and Iran defied it and never agreed to that to give more concessions, then the same old formula was back again. But 2 years ago, when Iran shut down the Global Hawk, when Iran took the British ship and never let it go until a month after they let Iranian Adrian tanker unload its cargo and leave the British territory or British-ruled territories in Gibraltar, and then 1 month later, Iran released the British ship and they were humiliated. And the masterpiece of all, Iran
staged a missile strike on the United States airbase at Ain al-Assad in western Iraq, and there were no responses. It was pretty well, you know, clear to everyone that the U.S. containment strategy is now in trouble because the threat, the military threat, doesn't work. Ever since then, that's the last sentence in this part.
Yeah, 30 seconds, Mostafa, because you're going to have the whole show. You're going to take the whole show. Give me just 30 more seconds. Go ahead.
Yeah,
go ahead. Finish your point.
Just one. Okay. And ever since then, the Israelis have been called in to play a complementary role for this lost military option that has failed to change Iranian calculations. But how do they do this? I'll talk about it later.
All right. Sounds good. Well, Brian, your take on what do you think exactly Biden meant when he says, okay, we'll try diplomacy. However, we're not ruling out other options. I mean, it sounds like the Obama and all options are on the table. I mean, what type of talk is this from so-called political leaders who want to talk about diplomacy? I mean, what exactly is this? Your take on this?
Well, it's very frightening, especially in the context of what's happening with the U.S. in effect defeat in Afghanistan, and Biden talking about putting our attention to other threats, looking at China, South China Sea, and Iran. When somebody talks about diplomacy but says all options are off the table, are on the table, especially the United States, which of all the declared nuclear nations is the only one that has not declared a no first use of nuclear weapons policy, it's hard to talk about diplomacy. We're not involved in diplomacy if you're saying from the beginning, if I don't get what I want, I'm going to kill you. That's not a diplomatic position to take, right. And it undermines anything that might come of this, because we really the conversation can't start when it's being backed by a threat, and especially as the United States now is in the middle of a multi-trillion-dollar stockpile stewardship, upgrading our nuclear weapons and violating the Non-Proliferation Treaty. In many, many ways, with bringing new nuclear weapons into Europe through NATO, and it's at a time when on the president's address to the world on Thursday, a time when it would have been very helpful for the United States, very diplomatic, to ask for forgiveness, but to say we will not forgive and we will hunt you down.
But isn't
very
that
dangerous
typical,
language.
I mean, isn't that just typical American jargon? I mean, staying with you, Brian, for a second, I'm American, and growing up and remembering the Westerns that we grew up with,
yes.
I mean, it's sort of the same type of jargon, just this time with people with suits on, but basically saying the same type of thing. It's like the duel and going out and who's going to pull the guns first. I mean, it seems like that same type of mentality that's coming from the White House.
Well, it isn't. The stakes are much higher. The stakes are global. The stakes are the survival of the human race and many other species with us. So my hope is I think if there's going to be a future for this world, it's going to be the United States. It's going to have to stop being the essential country. And take a more humbler place in the world.
Let's talk about that. Stay with me, Brian. What about that, Mostafa? If we're going to see a better world, the United States is going to have to take a more humble place. How do we get there? What does that take? And overall, how do you see this situation? How the United States looks at Iran as a major threat, and what does that say about Iran in itself?
Well, as a matter of fact, everyone knows that the U.S. Is moving on a slope towards demise as a global power, of course. And this is no secret. Even American thinkers, they have been acknowledging that. But the United States, is very tough when it comes to accepting the reality. They still behave in the Cold War, era, and it's very difficult for them
to come along with this reality that they cannot do dictates. They cannot make Iran step back. They need to accept and embrace the reality of Iran as a regional power which has legitimate interests. They may not force themselves into sovereign decision makings by Iran. If Iran believes that, you know, it needs to develop its nuclear industries, it's of course very open to the IAEA. They've never found anything, and they may not, you know, force Iran to stop or to slow down or to contain Iran's choices and decisions. It's very tough for them to agree to that. The Israelis, you know, they started this with Netanyahu standing back-to-back to the Dimona nuclear facility. And, you know, everyone knows that they have 200 to 400 nuclear warheads. And then he started perceived nuclear military threats to Iran from there, saying that if Tehran moves towards developing a nuclear bomb, we would evaporate them or annihilate them, something like that. It was a nuclear threat, and the world was silent. They never did anything. It was, you know, the UNSC, the UN Security Council, should have done something. Iranian Foreign Minister Mr. Zarif, I mean, the then Foreign Minister, said that it's a nuclear threat, but the world never did any kind of action. As long as the world tolerates the Israeli and American bullying, you know, behavior, they may not go for softening tone and changing their model and approach. And in the last, you know, 3-4 months, since Mr. Raisi came to power, they've been, you know, increasing threats. First, because they suspected that he would get back to the Vienna talks or not. And after they ensured that he would be back to the talks, now they are doing the same old thing. Threaten Iran, sanction Iran, keep Iran under pressure so that Iran would budge, so that Iran would give concessions in the Vienna talks. They have not even realized the reality that Raisi is in power. Those who voted for Raisi, they are the ones that were critics of Rouhani administration's foreign policy. They expect Raisi to even to do one of these two, either discard the JCPOA altogether because it has failed, you know, everything, all Iranian expectations, or go there and stand tough, much tougher than what Iran was doing under President Rouhani. And guess what? President Raisi has a more complicated plan to deal with the United States and Israel. With Amir Abdullahian in office, will Iran under Raisi and Amir Abdullahian would be a more powerful foe for the Israeli regime.
Okay,
and the Israeli
stay with me, Mostafa.
Okay,
well, Brian, what about that? I mean, it just appears that the United States, I mean, if we look at from the beginning of the victory of the Islamic Revolution in Iran, 1979, I mean, we're talking about 42 years. And so many of the options that they have taken, they just continue to repeat it, whether it's direct aggression, whether it's sanctions, or whether it's this tough type of talk. They have seen that basically they haven't been able to get anywhere with Iran over the years. Why hasn't the U.S. changed its strategy? Why does it still want to talk to Iran as it being the hegemon of the world and not basically listening to anyone else or feeling that anyone is worth listening to, especially from this region?
Yes, I think Mustafa is right that the United States, you know, our leaders, you know, politically, not facing the reality that the world has changed and we are not the superpower anymore, and we shouldn't be, and our attempts to remain so are killing us here at home, even if there isn't even short of a nuclear war with climate change we're not dealing with. I find it amazing that President Obama announced 2017, I think, a life extension program for nuclear weapons. Our stockpile is aging. We're putting money into the extension of the life of our nuclear weapons at a time when, for the first time in many, many years, the life expectancy of American citizens is actually going down. We're not living as long, but we're putting our resources in keeping these weapons that can kill us all going. So the empire is going to die. They you know, they all do. But I don't think we can be take a whole lot of comfort in that.
How much is the role that Washington has with Tel Aviv playing in that empire dying? Staying with you, Brian.
Well, I think it's. I'm happy that August 11th, Peter Beinhart wrote an op-ed piece in the New York Times, which has a lot to be desired, but at least it was admitting that Israel has a nuclear weapons program and the United States is ignoring it. Now, this deliberate ambiguity is the word that they use. And we're actually violating, the United States is violating its own laws and the international law, because we should not be giving any military aid to any country that has nuclear weapons that has not signed the Non-Proliferation Treaty. And that of course, is Israel. So all of our military aid to Israel is criminal. But as long as that isn't admitted, as long as everybody has to know, because like I said, it's all the threats are even if they're not spoken, they're tacit threats.
Okay.
We use a nuclear weapon every day. Israel uses nuclear weapons every day, just by the very fact that the world knows that they have them. And if they don't get their way, who knows what will happen? This is a threat.
Okay. Well, Mustafa, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, said basically they're the same. I mean, with Trump or Biden, they're the same. They may speak a little bit different language, but basically the results are the same. And Ali Shamkhani, the Secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council, and he, responding to the threats, he said that Iran will reciprocate if the United States initiated it. So tell me what all of this means and how dangerous is the situation.
Well, that's the crucial part. As a matter of fact, the most important statements to make are these. When the U.S. has failed to change Iran's decision-making in the last several years through its military threats, as I explained, after all the three, developments in the Persian Gulf, the last one being Ain al-Assad missile raining, how come do they expect that Israel, which is a smaller, it's 1/16 the size of the Iranian population, it's way smaller than Iran, and it doesn't have allies like what Iran has all around them, laying a siege on them on the occupied territories. How do they expect that they can pose military threats to Iran and change Iranian decision making? Well, they've been playing in a space or room between peace and war. They call it 1,000 non-lethal scars on Iran to kill Iran, as very well defined in an Axios report yesterday, I believe. They imagine that if they go for moves like attacking Natanz through cyber attacks, through bombings, or assassinating Iranian nuclear scientists like Dr. Fakhrizadeh, or attacking Iranian cargo ships as well as tankers, then they won't receive a response. That's the exact miscalculation. Whenever they've done something bad to Iran, they have received a response, especially in the last couple of years. Iran would never sit idly. But before the election, here is the miscalculation that the Israelis have made, and they continue with that, apparently, now that Naftali Bennett is there and is offering Biden the same kind of approach. Well, that's the mistake which would kill them if they go for the first mistake. The difference lies in this very fact that before Iranian election, Iranian responses were parallel and to the same level, and in order for deterrence, they came with a similar power or force. But now after the election, having a Raisi administration that's very close to the parliament, to even the Tehran municipality, as well as, all the branches of power are close to each other, including the military. They are all close to, the viewpoints and strategies of Raisi. Iran is now in a different stage, acting much more powerfully. That means what Shamkhani said, which was very, vitally important, was this very fact that if from now on the Israelis continue with this strategy, the kind of responses they will receive
would be devastating, and count on that. I do believe that. I've been saying that for the past 6 months, that Iran's responses after the election would be totally different, much more powerful, first. Second, the Israelis would become history if they go for similar mistakes because of the miscalculations they've been making, because the Israelis are always in a rush when it comes to assessment. There are multiple reasons why they act so hastily, but that's their nature. They arrive at conclusions too fast, and sometimes mistakes are killing.
Okay. Well, unfortunately, we're out of time. I appreciate both of you being with me for this spotlight. Political analyst Mostafa Khoshchesh out of Tehran, and political commentator and peace activist Brian Terrell out of Moloy, Iowa. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on this spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashemi, signing out for myself and other crew right here in Tehran. Goodbye.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
The United States has a responsibility to provide a safe haven for refugees from Afghanistan, Latin America, or elsewhere, and to cease interventions that fuel these crises and displace so many. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written jointly by Amy Goodman and Dennis Moynihan writers. This article is published under the heading From Afghanistan to Central America, U.S. Creates Refugee Crises. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. The United States has long branded itself as a safe haven for refugees fleeing war and persecution abroad. The current U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan is actually a testament to that, with well over 100,000 people evacuated by U.S. since mid-August. Despite this historic airlift, the Biden administration is being relentlessly criticized. The airlift continued despite a double suicide bombing at the gates of the Kabul airport recently that killed at least 9 Afghans and 13 U.S. service members, injuring at least 140. If there is any chaos as U.S.-aligned Afghans scramble to flee their war-torn nation, blame lies primarily with the U.S. administration. And President Trump's right-hand man, his racist, xenophobic advisor, Stephen Miller. Another exodus is happening halfway around the world as asylum seekers from Central America make the perilous journey to the U.S.-Mexico border. There, they face draconian U.S. immigration policies that consign them to remain in Mexico. Much like Afghan civilians caught in the crossfire of that 20-year war, these migrants live in constant danger in squalid, makeshift refugee camps in the Mexican border cities, waiting for a chance at asylum in the United States. If there is any chaos as U.S.-aligned Afghans scramble to flee their war-torn nation, blame lies primarily with the United States administration. Miller's anti-immigrant fervor was driven early on by listening to right-wing radio host Larry Elder, who is now the leading candidate to replace California Governor Gavin Newsom in a recall election. Olivia Troy, who was an aide to Vice President Mike Pence, tweeted recently, "The War Cabinet MTGS about this during the Trump administration, where Stephen Miller would peddle his racist hysteria about Iraq and Afghanistan. He and his enablers across government would undermine anyone who worked on solving the SIV or special immigrant visa issue by devastating the system at DHS and state. Trump had 4 years to evacuate these Afghan allies who were the lifelines for many of us who spent time in Afghanistan. They had been waiting a long time. The process slowed a trickle for reviews and other priorities then came to a halt." Miller also engineered the Migrant Protection Protocols, or MPP, better known as the Remain in Mexico policy. Human Rights First recently issued a report, Delivered to Danger, that documented at least 1,544 publicly reported cases of murder, rape, torture, kidnapping, and other violent assaults against asylum seekers and migrants forced to return to Mexico by the U.S. administration. A 97-page appendix accompanies the report, listing the crimes with chilling detail. On Inauguration Day, President Biden issued several executive orders, including one revoking the anti-immigrant executive order Trump issued during his first week in office in 2017. The Department of Homeland Security immediately suspended enrolling migrants in the MPP program. In response, the states of Texas and Missouri sued the Biden administration, and on August 13th, Texas federal judge Matthew Kachmerk, a Trump appointee, ruled that the White House must immediately re-implement the Remain in Mexico policy. The U.S. Justice Department appealed, and within 2 weeks, a three-judge appeals court affirmed the lower court's decision. Two of those three appeals court judges were Trump appointees. Andrew Oldham, who was just 39, when confirmed to his lifetime appointment in 2018, and Corey Wilson, who is now 51. Both are fierce right-wing ideologues. A request for stay pending federal litigation was quickly rejected by the Supreme Court by 6-3. The Biden administration still uses Title 42, first deployed by Trump, allowing deportations and immigration bans in times of public health emergencies. Trump's CDC issued the Title 42 order in March 2020 as the pandemic swept the globe, and Biden renewed it on August 2nd. The U.S. government reported a record 210,000 migrant apprehensions along the southern border in July. Many of these people hail from the so-called Northern Triangle countries of El Salvador, Honduras, and Guatemala, where widespread inequality, systematic corruption, food insecurity, gang violence, and now climate change are forcing people from their homes. These problems have long been exacerbated by U.S. military, economic, and political interventions in the region. The United States engaged in dirty wars in Central America and has supported coups against democratically elected governments there, from overthrowing the government of Jacobo Arbenz in Guatemala in 1954 to actively supporting the coup against President Manuel Zelaya in Honduras in 2009. Likewise, the United States armed and supported the Afghan Mujahideen in their fight against the Soviet Union. Many of those armed Mujahideen then aimed their American weapons at the U.S. This led to the disastrous two-decades-long U.S. war, with tens of thousands killed and millions displaced. The United States regime has a responsibility to provide a safe haven for refugees from Afghanistan, Latin America, or elsewhere, and to cease interventions that fuel these crises and displace so many people.